all those contracts. in spite of the concession that our government would have made, that they would have told us about, we also have a duty in terms of our constitution to get inputs from South Africans, a parliament now. A parliament, we have a duty to get South Africans to make their own input and submission. We will speak to that, to the process at the end of the presentation. How do we take this parliamentary process forward? But this just serves to point and to paint what we are about to do today, and what informs what we are about to do. Obviously, whatever inputs and submissions that our government makes to the UN, to the UN United Nations framework on climate change, that input cannot escape first starting here in Parliament. It can't escape. So that's why they are starting here to tell us where they are. But also, Parliament can't escape making our government position available to the public so that the public make their submission and comments on the government position or discussion position that will inform the government's final submission to the COP21. So we are quite happy to welcome you here, Alf, and your colleague. But as colleagues will also know, when we went to Lima, we also undertook some public hearings in almost three provinces, where our people in those provinces said that yes, we do need a binding agreement, an enforceable agreement in this area of climate change. So we did get that broad principled mandate from our people, and I'm told that in the speech by the president, there was added a sentence or two that reflected on the work that was done by Parliament in the run-up or before we all went to Lima. So again, we're expected to do our bit in to ensure that our people participate in the final submission in COP21. So as now you are on your own, I see that there is no acting head of department, so they've sent you guys on your own to come and make this presentation. You're most welcome. The platform is yours. You know everybody who's here.
Yes, thank you, Honorable Chair. First of all, if I could start with an apology from the Director General. The scheduling of Parliament is quite tricky. The Director General is presenting the department's plans to the SADC committee in Mpumalanga. So her apologies. Apologies also from the Minister. She is in Paris doing informal ministerial consultations on climate change. I don't know whether that gives me acting DG status, but I will do my best, Honorable Chair.
You are not alone. Introduce your colleague.
Okay. I have with me the real expert on national implementation of climate change. She is Deborah Ramalope. She's the Chief Director of Mitigation. And we are talking to a large extent in the INDC on the mitigation. And I suppose the key question that we have to answer to Parliament is how South Africa is going to meet its proposed intended nationally determined contribution. She has prepared a presentation for the committee on South Africa's national mitigation system, so that you can get a sense of how it is we intend to meet Honourable Chair, is to really give a context within which we are making these submissions and developing our national mitigation system in the international context. If you will recall the previous briefings, in effect, this phase of the negotiation began in 2001 when President Bush announced that the USA would not join the Kyoto Protocol. And the climate, international climate architecture at that point was designed in a way that developed countries had legally binding obligations and developing countries had obligations which were not quantified. So they, developed countries had quantified, and the Kyoto system provided for the ability for developed countries to meet its legal obligations by buying credits through sustainable development efforts in developing countries. So that was the architecture of the system where one group had legal obligations, but they were able to meet it by investing in sustainable development in the group which didn't have quantified legal obligations. The fact that the U.S. decided not to join the Kyoto Protocol took over 25% of all the emissions out of that system. And in fact, as the confidence in the Kyoto system degraded, so other countries jumped ship. Russia, Canada, Japan, Australia, all began to jump ship to the point where less than 13% of all the emissions were covered by the Kyoto system. So that necessitated this phase of the negotiations of a new international architecture in order to rebalance the system. At the moment, at the beginning or through this negotiating phase, there have been two competing architecture paradigms in the international negotiations. The one is a more Kyoto style, top-down, saying this is the number of megatons that have to be mitigated in a top-down agreement where multilateral commitments are driven by a system of attributing responsibility to different parties. Those would be multilateral commitments, they would be internationally legally binding, they would be accounted for in terms of common multilaterally agreed rules and criteria, and it would be driven by the science at the end of the day. A second competing paradigm has been the bottom-up style, where countries self-determine what they can contribute on a unilateral basis. The legal nature of those self-determined commitments are under review or under discussion. They could be multilaterally legally binding, or they could be on the end of the spectrum domestically legally binding. And in this case, the level of ambition is informed by their national priorities and circumstances. And the binding part of this type of agreement would be binding rules, binding reporting, binding review procedures. So the binding part is much less, not necessarily the actual numbers being binding. If we just look at the next slide. You try. Just push the arrow. It's frozen. Honourable members, I presume that you do have the presentation in your pack while we wait for the technology to catch up. Okay, so in essence, three phases of this since 2001. One has been initiating, and that ended in COP11 in Montreal in 2005, where we set up a negotiation of a second commitment period under Kyoto as a transition, and we entered into the negotiations under the convention of a system which would capture the U.S. and all those that have jumped ship from Kyoto, as well as developing countries. That period, that negotiation ended up in Durban. And in Durban, we agreed that we would establish a second commitment period, and we established a what we call the Durban Platform for Enhanced Action under the convention, the so-called ADP negotiating structure. In Doha, in COP18 2012, the actual amendment to the Kyoto Protocol for a second commitment period up till 2020 was adopted. In Warsaw in 2013, the ADP negotiations had progressed to the point where it was agreed that all countries should enter into a period of preparation for submitting intended nationally determined contributions, in other words, our national homework, to accelerate full implementation. And at the same time, to look at means to enhance ambition, or mitigation ambition in particular, in the pre-2020 period, remembering that this negotiation is now divided into two periods, a so-called work stream one, which deals with commitments and an agreement, a legal agreement, in the post-2020 period, as well as negotiations on the implementation, enhanced implementation, pre-2020, and that is called work stream two in the negotiations. In Lima, we agreed on the upfront information that the intended nationally determined contribution should contain, and we set up a Lima call for climate action on the pre-2020. We're now going into the final year of our negotiations set up in Durban in 2011, which is going to end in Paris in COP21, and in essence, the objectives for Paris is to develop a protocol or another legal instrument for an agreed outcome with legal force under the convention, which is applicable to all parties, both developed and developing. This is the post-2020, so that would come into force from 2020 onwards. And as part of that process, it is agreed that by October this year, all countries would submit its intended nationally determined contributions to this post-2020 implementation regime. The object of this is to determine, is to be able to make a political judgment in Paris whether or not the contributions that countries are making are, first of all, fair and just, and second of all, whether or not they add up to what would be required by science in terms of the level of ambition to avoid dangerous climate change and keep the global warming below 2 degrees post-second commitment period up to 2020 from some developed countries. We've got in Cancun, we agreed to pledges from the US and other countries which are not part of Kyoto, including developing countries. So we need to ensure the implementation of those existing commitments, including the mobilization of $100 billion per year by 2020 for climate action. And finally, at a principal level, we would like to see parity between adaptation and mitigation in the post-2020 system. At the moment, adaptation is a poor cousin. Everyone is focused on mitigation. But with a 2-degree global warming, the interior of Africa is projected to hit 4 or 5 degrees, and the impacts of a 4 or 5 degree in the interior of the African continent are quite severe. So Africa's priority is to enhance the actual implementation at a global level on adaptation. Our expectations, next slide please. Our expectations for the 2015 agreement are that the post-2020 system would be driven by multilaterally agreed rules and that it would be legally binding. Now, I did say that there were some nuances to the legal bindingness discussion, but at a principal level, it needs to be legally binding. We need to ensure that the system that we build is adequate and actually can get us to a below 2-degree world. And that implies that the agreement must provide for countries, all countries, to transition to a low emission and climate resilient economies and societies in order to be able to fulfill the objectives of the convention, which is in essence to prevent dangerous climate change within a time frame that enables adaptation and sustainable development. And in this respect, because there will be unavoidable impacts of climate change in a 2-degree world.
Just a minute. Can't we have another? If that one is not assisting us, let's get another one that can assist us. If it won't, then move it.
There's no change.
Then let's move to where we are now. So it is taken forever. But where do you... But go on.
Okay. So in that context, Africa's position for giving equal priority to adaptation and mitigation with means of implementation, support for the implementation, finance, technology, development and transfer, and capacity building are essential elements of the Paris Agreement. And that these arrangements must be inclusive, involve the participation of all parties, be fair in terms of common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities, and environmentally effective. So those fundamentally are the expectations for the structure of the agreement. On the next slide, honourable members, we just briefly outline a summary of the South African...
Before you go to the next slide, you have not touched on the fulfillment of Article 2 objectives.
Yeah, the objectives. I did say that the Article 2 objective, in essence, is to prevent dangerous climate change within the time frame that allows for adaptation and sustainable development. In summary, that's what it says. So... this giving equal priority to adaptation and mitigation and the means of implementation is a means by which we can achieve the prevention of dangerous climate change, as well as giving time for adaptation and our position for Paris COP. For the post 2020 regime, the 2050, what we call the 2015 agreement, it has to be under the convention in accordance with all the provisions of the convention, including its principles, which includes the principle of equity and common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities, as well as all its provisions on commitments by parties and commitments to act and commitments to report, as well as commitments to support. So it's, in essence, it's that range of commitments that, that we want to see. It needs to be built in a manner that is consistent with the science and equity, and further enhance the implementation of a multilateral rules-based system. There needs to be legal parity, in particular between mitigation and adaptation, and we need to ensure that the levels of ambition, the mechanisms to achieve levels of ambition, including the intended nationally determined contributions and other measures, will keep the world on track to a well below 2 degrees Celsius world. On the workstream 2, which is the pre-2020, we believe that early, well, the science tells us that early ambitious action is paramount to keep the world on the 2 degree track. So implementation pre-2020 is paramount. So we give equal priority to implementation pre-2020 as we give to the development of a post-2020 legal system. so we're calling on all developed countries to ratify the second commitment period of Kyoto as a first. And we're calling on, if those countries that don't want to join Kyoto, we're calling on them to at least fulfill their pledges that they made in Cancun in Mexico, because all developed countries have made pledges, so they need to implement that. And the third piece of this puzzle, which is not in the presentation, is Workstream 2, which is saying, over and above the pledges, is there additional mitigation opportunities that through international cooperation we can realize in order to close the gap? So that's the third element of this work. On that set of issues that are pre-2020 implementation, under the convention, there are what we call subsidiary bodies. There are two subsidiary bodies. One on called the subsidiary body on implementation, and the other one on subsidiary body on scientific and technological advice. Now, all those pre-2020 enhanced implementation details are being dealt with in these subsidiary bodies. And I'm not going to go through, I think, into the summary of the positions, South African positions with respect to these issues are in the paper. But just to list them, we have work on adaptation, we have work on mitigation, and we have work on response measures. If I could just explain response measures. Response measures are managing the unintended consequences of other countries' mitigation actions on other countries. So whether they intended or unintended, we can't say that they intended. But in reality, we are experiencing impacts of other countries' mitigation actions on our economies. I'll give a concrete example. In Kenya, the cut flower industry was closed, or because the Netherlands put an embargo on the import of cut flowers from Kenya into the international cut flower market, which is driven through Rotterdam. I don't know whether you're aware. It's a huge global industry of cut flowers. The fact of the matter is that the logic behind that ban was that the transport emissions from flying the cut flowers from Nairobi to Rotterdam were too high, and they could source the same cut flowers from Eastern European countries. When we did the actual analysis of those cut flowers from Eastern European countries which are grown in hothouses, the carbon footprint of the hothouse cut flowers was larger than the Kenyan ones, the transport carbon footprint. So, you know, these kinds of technical trade barriers are beginning to be seen related directly to a climate change logic. So those that we call response measures, and we need the international multilaterally agreed system to manage those unintended consequences of mitigation policies and measures. The next area is pre-2020 finance, and to a large extent this is around closing or elaborating, clarifying the pathway where we get how to get to $100 billion US dollars per year by 2020 in terms of providing finance. We then have an area of work on capacity building, and we are looking for the establishment of a international capacity building mechanism to ensure capacity development, particularly in developing countries. And finally, I apologize, there's an area of work under technology. We did set up in Durban two mechanisms on technology, a technology executive committee and a climate technology center and network to map out technology roadmaps and facilitate the deployment of low carbon technologies at an affordable and accessible prices across the world. So there's further work. Next slide, please. The other next. There you go. Okay, and that brings us to where we stand at the moment, Honourable Chair. As I was briefing you a little earlier, we've just come back from Germany, where we've completed the penultimate session of negotiations under the Durban Platform for Enhanced Action, or the ADP. Where we stand at the moment is that on the two work streams, the pre-2020 work stream and the post-2020 work stream, we have completed the process of putting compromise proposals, new concepts, new ideas into a language form. The co-chairs of the ADP, which is a co-chair from Algeria, Africa, Ahmed Joglaf, and a co-chair from the USA, Dan Riefsnyder, have been given the mandate to take all of that material that was put forward by parties produce a relatively clean text that could form the basis of negotiation at our next session, which is in October, late October. The political confidence in this process, particularly for the post-2020 system, needs to be supported by an understanding of what countries will actually take into Paris as part of the Paris Agreement in terms terms of their nationally determined commitments going forward. And the intent, as I mentioned earlier, is that countries need to be able to see what others are doing in order to be assured that their contribution is actually fair relative to other countries. And this is not a numbers game. There are different, many wide-ranging models of quantifying the responsibility, the global responsibility of a particular country. And all of those different methodologies from a scientific, technical perspective have been under fire in terms of critique. So in real terms, this judgment of whether or not your contribution is fair relative to others is more of a political judgment than it is a quantified judgment, largely because of the academic fighting around what the appropriate criteria for equity actually is. South Africa has used three criteria: capability, access to sustainable development or sustainable development, as well as the what we call responsibility. And the problem with responsibility is, do you calculate it from 1850, or is it calculated from 1900, or is it calculated from 1960? So it depends on what you choose as to what the responsibility actually is. But nevertheless, we have, as South Africa, in the process of developing our intended nationally determined contributions, used the 1850 level, and we have at least informed our intended nationally determined contribution by those three more rigorous criteria. We are in the process of developing our intended nationally determined contributions. We have engaged intensively. We have published a discussion document in the Government Gazette. We have consulted intensively with labour, business, and the NGO community, and we have had eight provincial consultation workshops with stakeholders at provincial level, with the last one happening on Thursday in the Eastern Cape. And then, Honourable Chairperson, you have indicated your intent to hold public hearings on the discussion document on the 22nd and 23rd of September. So all of these inputs into that discussion document will be taken into account in finalising our intended nationally determined contribution, which we have to communicate during that final negotiating session in October, at the end of October. Our intended nationally contribution, we intend to put our intended nationally determined contribution in by the end of October, which is the deadline which has been set in Lima. So far, 49 countries have submitted intended nationally determined contributions, and over 60% of those countries have included adaptation as part of their intended nationally determined contribution. The US and the European Union have submitted adaptation undertakings separately from their intended nationally determined contribution. So if you recall in Lima, the inclusion of adaptation in the intended nationally determined contribution submission was a voluntary basis. So for South Africa's intended nationally determined contribution, we have four elements to our intended nationally determined contribution. The first element being adaptation, because it's a very key and critical area for South Africa, as we are extremely vulnerable, especially our rural communities are extremely vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, particularly if we are in a 3, 4, or 5 degree world in going forward. The impacts to a large extent for South Africa are water related, and all the things attached to water. So it is food security, it is public health, it is water dependent industry, including our energy. You will recall all of our power plants are driven by steam, whether the heating of the water is from coal or from gas or from nuclear, it's steam driven. So water is a very key area for our energy system, and that links in to a large extent into our industrialization policy and process and basic economic activities. So to a large extent, water is our biggest vulnerability. We do have other vulnerabilities. We've got sea level rise, where we have coastal erosion of our coastal infrastructure. We've got shifting rain, slow onset shifting rainfall patterns. So the impacts on our subsistence fisheries industry, impacts on our wine and fruit and wheat and maize sectors of agriculture, all of which shifting rainfall patterns have severe long-term economic impacts. In terms of our mitigation, INDC, I'm not going to deal in detail with this because Deborah is going to give you a presentation on the national mitigation system. But safe to say that one of the principles or one of the criteria which has emerged in the process of negotiating our post-2020 system is that there should be what they call a principle of progression. So in effect, what that means is that a country's commitment that you made in 2010 in Mexico, or 9 in Copenhagen and Mexico, you should progress that commitment to a more ambitious kind of commitment, so that over time the ambition goes in a one way. You don't backslide. So that's an expectation of countries. So in 2009 and 2010, President Zuma put forward a commitment which was a deviation from business as usual. So we calculated a business as usual trajectory, and then we said we'll mitigate, and our mitigation actions would deviate from business as usual by 32% by 2020, and 34% by 2020, and 42% by 2025. So this INDC is a progression from that form. The criticism of the deviation from business as usual is that it's a modeled line. It's not a real line. It doesn't actually, you're not measuring it against reality. It's all in cyberspace. So the baselines for the business as usual trajectory are a moving goalpost from year to year, depending on how your economy does, and also depending on whether or not you improve your reporting and measurement of emissions and so on and so forth. So the INDC is shifting now to a trajectory range, which means where we put tons. So instead of being a percentage deviation, we're now talking about millions of tons of carbon, actual tons, but in a range, in order to give us still the flexibility, because we're still learning as we go. So it's a real progression from a relative, difficult to measure form of commitment to a commitment which is measured in tons. So that is the progression. I just wanted to give that message, and Deborah can give you the detail. On the fundamental question, I suppose, that the committee needs to consider is how South Africa will meet its commitment that we put forward in the intended nationally determined contribution, because we don't want to make a commitment that we can't meet. Then the other two key elements of this is our consideration of equity. So if you recall, I did say that South Africa used three criteria. We did not approach the equity question and suck our thumb. We actually did what we consider to be a fairly objective assessment of what our global responsibility is and how much we should be contributing to the global effort with those three criteria: sustainable development, responsibility, and capability. And finally, a very important piece of this puzzle is the means of implementation. So what at a global level needs to happen in order to enable us to access affordable technologies that we can deploy on an economy-wide scale in order to achieve our numbers. Our experience has been with the renewable energy program, for an example, that the first bits were quite expensive per kilowatt hour, R2, in the region of R2. And these latest bits, as our more local content is coming into the technology and actual costs are reducing, we now get bids at 75, 77 cents per kilowatt hour. So big scale investment in technology across the world drives cost curves down and enhances access and affordability. So a fundamental assumption is that we require this means of implementation, which is finance, technology, and capacity building as part and parcel of this global system. So with that, Chair, I don't know whether you want to ask questions on this particular part of the thing, or do you want Deborah to go over the mitigation system?
The mitigation system speaks to the mitigation path that we will pursue post 2020, or even, because again, in your document was saying we must take into cognition prior agreements that we have reached. So probably it will speak to both pre and post. But before we even cross that one might be something that speaks to your INDCs in terms of what you have said, tons, or whether we're still on the percentages, and how do we convert those percentages present both to in Copenhagen to these tons that you're speaking to. But having said that, then let me allow colleagues. I know this was a mouthful, and that's the problem with these scientists. They want to hide what they say, and they don't write it. They don't write it, they speak to it. So that you don't ask that many questions. Because if they have written it, then you'll ask many, many questions. Colleagues, let's hear what you have to say. And I will tell you, my own view is that let us speak in simple language, not in the rhetoric of negotiation. Because we are parliamentarians, and all of us are parliamentarians, we can't explain this climate change and the catastrophe that might, or that is in fact starting to defend our people in terms that have been said by us. We can only talk to them in terms that our people understand. And I will also then urge you to ask your questions in a manner that our people will understand, so that as we go out there, and also he has said we will be engaging with some people, maybe some that they have not engaged with, engaged with industry, with labor, they've engaged with provinces. We might call for proposals and submissions to the government discussion document and get other people who come from these universities. But we must also make them speak in a language for them, so that we understand what they are saying, so that they speak in a language that we can understand ourselves. And this is what I will request. Now, this is a request that we have been making to Alf and Judy, that speak in simple language. Now, they always bring all these big terms, but be that as it may, I have no problem where you start. Colleagues who start. Mabilo, Kegana, Hatebe, Makubela, yes, in that order.
No, thanks, Chair. There's no doubt in terms of your, as you, Chair, assessing us that this climate change issue is quite critical and scientific. The first statistic in question that I would pose to you, Alf, is around your introduction pertaining to the architect apparat. Paradigm in global negotiations. You've given us two scenarios, one a top-down Kyoto-style agreement driven by requirements of science. The other one is a bottom-up style driven by flesh and review systems. But now, what I must was to say, from a South African perspective, which model do we favor or approach, do we prefer? Are we comfortable with? And what are the pros and cons of whatever approach you will be entering into? Secondly, I'm aware that South Africa is not negotiating alone with the African bloc. What is the perspective of Africa around us, in particular in the developing world? That would be my first statistic in question. Secondly,
the second one.
Just around the deadline of October. October is just a couple of weeks ago. I mean, away from us. So in terms of, there's no doubt that our country will be able to meet our LDLC. What I want to check is that, is there coordination, is there cooperation, is there coherence in the African bloc, in particular in the developing world, to meet this deadline of October? I'll follow up after the chair, given the other colleagues the opportunity. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Megagan.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. But for department, thanks very much for what we have achieved up to here. My question is not too big. As a department, do you think our negotiation system are treating us some way? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Mine is to ask about the Green Fund. I know we had something like 1 billion, which is managed by SADD. how I would like to know how accessible is it to the business and industry in South Africa so that we motivate them to go green. And yeah, I just want to know this, how accessible to the business, because I surely if you motivate by telling them that there is a green fund that you've got and it will help you for you to go cleaner, there will be no sort of like resistance from industry to comply with our INDC. I think I would like to know that. Thank you.
My questions will be around the two areas. And I do agree with your chairman that this should be somewhat simplified. I thought you were saying half should be reducing this to Sesotho. I do get the elements around which on both that are imagined on our intended national determined responsibility. But I take it in today's briefing, we haven't got exactly what we're seeking to correct, isn't it? We're still going to developing laws and consolidating them, so that we are more clear on beyond October what we're taking there. What I'm not sure, Chair, is whether we will have another briefing to then say this is what finally has been worked out. That's one part. The two areas I wanted some clarity on is one around the response measures. You know, the pace at which we are moving, although it's annual, it's like a very big shift that takes long to change. Now, as you move, there are challenges that are experienced. And some are the ones you referred to in terms of Kenyan example, the Nairobi experience. Now, how rapid is this response measure? Are we moving at the same pace? Or you may find that the response measure is moving at a pace that is lower or less than that of the challenges that are being experienced. I had an experience of seeing one car. It is it's a private security car. It said the rapid response team. But when it starts, you must push it first. But it's a rapid response vehicle. They have not yet started on it. So this response measure may need to be clarified whether it's not in that context. The second one, which is much more difficult area, I wonder if, I think it may not respond to it here and now, the political judgment that you are not able to quantify what countries are able to do in terms of equity and responsibility. How close are we to the actual quantity than the political judgment? For how long will this take? Because it can't just be that to the extent to which countries are willing to participate, but you can't tell in terms of what are they able to do. Because I thought the measure was that the system that we're following should be able to tell scientifically all of these countries what are capable of doing. But if we'll be measuring that based on their political commitment, we still manufacture from close to each other. Paris will come and go, and even the next one will not be able to clarify at this point. Thank you.
I'm not going to be out of order now, but I just want to check if how can we help farmers to adapt on climate action?
Then let me ask the difficult ones. On our political approach, and I will take it that will also be Africa's approach because we are the most vulnerable. That any adaptation with any action plan on climate change, that you can't just be speaking about mitigation addition when you cannot say how do you adapt to the reality that is facing us today. Adaptation is the linking of mind. In the negotiations that you are part of now, on this position that we hold, and therefore, the position that reinforces the need for the capacitation of that other fund, not the little one that we have here, the little group, that international adaptation fund, to the tune of 100 billion. Because if we are unable to do that and ensure that there is access to technology by developing countries, that already is sitting with the developed world, we might as well call this initiative off before it gets started. If we are unable to ensure that there is meeting of minds politically on this matter, you said that when we were struggling with, that's the second one, when we were struggling with Kyoto Protocol, obviously the U.S. did not ratify, but because they did not, many others also jumped ship. We were then left with about, 18% of emissions that we, now that was just useless. So COP17 needed to bring everybody back. That's why then the second commitment to Kyoto Protocol, so that we bring everybody back, all developed nations back, from where we are seated now, because we have been busy with political negotiations up to now. And we are also saying that, you know, the chairs are trying to put those together for discussions that are in English. I don't know in what language you guys are speaking there, but the chairs of the two groups are meeting so that they put everything together and they will put it before you so that there is some form of agreement. Where are we, particularly on the definition of what is a developed country? Because that's where America was a little bit difficult. They said that no, China can't claim not to be a developed country with the levels of emission. So where are we? These are all political discussions, political discourse. You should have a better sense of where you are sitting. And what is the attitude of all those, particularly your U.S. and your China? These are the major economies. If we can't have them leading us in this area on both adaptation and the mitigation ambition, we might as well call it quits. But what is the attitude of these major players in these negotiations where we are now, understanding what South Africa would want to get out of this? Thank you.
We'll jump ship now, yeah.
Thank you very much. No, Chair, I just want
been crafting this legally binding agreement by the countries, how possible to effect that? You look on those countries who didn't participate in the second Kyoto Protocol. Yeah, that's it. I just would like to know how possible to effect the legal binding agreement by the parties on those countries.
We know that this is not the end, this is just the start. Because we have not even gone to town on our own education ambition in hand now. That would be interesting. But let's hear from you on those broad parameters.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Deborah to help me on some of the technical issues, maybe. But let me begin. In terms of the two paradigms, they're two ends of the spectrum. So you get the bottom-up legislation review, and you get the top-down attribution of responsibility. In essence, what South Africa approached is to try and get a mix of both. So you will understand that the fact that we're talking about INDCs, that's a bottom-up. That's bottom-up. But what we are aiming for in the text of the legal agreement that we are negotiating is we want to get the bottom-up by rules. What are the parameters? It's not a free-for-all, a wild, wild west. What are the parameters that every country needs to put in place in terms of how it determines it determines nationally its contribution, and according to what criteria, how it's going to report, measure them, how it's going to report them, and add them up. So our approach and Africa's approach has been one of pragmatism, to be really honest. So we started off this negotiation with a top-down model. But the reality in the global terms is that we see that if you put a Kyoto on the table, the US won't join, and all the others that jump ship. Pragmatically, they will remain outside, and then we've got an agreement which does not have the participation of all. I think the chair was alluding to, the chair was alluding to in COP17, the big challenge for COP17 is how do we bring everyone back into the fold? And if you remember the COP17, the Durban deal, if you want, the Durban deal was three things. It was, number one, let's take a second commitment period under Kyoto. And the reason that we wanted that is not so much that you've got more than 13% of the world emissions there, but you wanted to maintain the rules, the top-down rules. How do you account? How do you add up? How do you enforce? So to keep Kyoto on the table as a live instrument to inform the negotiation of the post-2020 system, we needed a live instrument with the rules. So that was number one. The second part of the deal was that we agreed that Kyoto would be replaced by another legal agreement, which is under the convention and applicable to all countries. So everyone will be involved in the post-2020 system. And the third part of the deal was everyone acknowledged that the Copenhagen commitments or pledges in which we formalized in Cancun, at COP16 in Cancun, were not insufficient to take us to a 2-degree world. And so there was this work stream too under the ADP, which was focused on pre-2020 ambition. How do we ambition. So that was the deal, and that was the deal terms of the deadlines, I agree, October is a short time.
And let me also add that, will that answer also his question whether all players are now on
that,
board?
That's both questions. The Cancun pledges and maintaining the rules of Kyoto Protocol. That are the two parts of that. In terms of deadline, yes, October is a short time. But to be really honest, nationally determined contributions, countries in Africa have not coordinated on their national sovereignty to determine their own contribution. At the moment as we stand, eight African countries have submitted INDCs already. And our understanding, particularly in the Southern African region, is that most countries in the Southern African region will meet the October deadline, including ourselves. I'm not sure whether the October deadline is going to be met by every single country, but we do anticipate that at least 80 or 90% of the world submissions will be covered by October, which is really what we kind of aiming for. Remember that the Cancun pledges is just under 80% of all the missions. So even the Cancun pledges did not cover all countries. There's still around about 20% of world emissions not included in the Cancun pledges, the Copenhagen Cancun pledges. Honorable Kikan, this is a question. Are the negotiations going somewhere? Yes. If we get a Paris Agreement that does attract the participation of all countries, even if the level of ambition is not equal to what's required by science, as long as you build a system where you have implementation cycles and this principle, as I explained, of no backsliding and progression, then you've got a system where you ratchet up ambition. So as the confidence in the climate change system grows and everyone is seeing that everyone else is doing what they said they would do, and you get confidence and trust building, so the system, we want to build a system which organically ramps up ambition over a long period of time. It's a bit of a what they call a vicious circle. So if you haven't got big investment in low carbon technology, then low carbon technology is expensive. And especially for developing countries, we can't afford to deploy low carbon technology, expensive low carbon technology. So you need to build a system where you ramp up the investment globally, global investment, not the investment in your own country, but globally, so that the global cost prices go down, so that they become accessible and affordable. And so we want to build a system which reverses the cycle to the dive to the bottom, the race to the bottom, and we want to get a system which we race to the top. That's basically the kind of thing. So yes, my assessment is that we have a good possibility in Paris to conclude such an agreement, even if the pledges, when you add up all the INDCs, it's still not sufficient in terms of what science requires. But you've built a system where you're ramping up ambition over time. At the moment, it's emerging that this post 2020 Paris Agreement will operate in 5-year cycles. So every 5 years you've got a review, and so you ramp up. And that's why we as South Africa look in our INDCs, we have a 2025 number and we have a 2030 number. So that it's 5-year. Okay. On the Green Fund, the Green Fund fund, and 75% of the fund is for actual demonstration projects on the ground. We have 23 demonstration projects at the moment approved and implementing, all on different technologies covering from building efficiency, waste recycling, green natural resource management, wildlife farming, and so on and so forth, as well as a green cities program. So that's the green fund. At the moment, 100% of the allocated funds are committed to projects. We have an MTF allocation of 300 million this year, 190 million next year, and 110 million on the outer year. Only the 110 million is not allocated at this point in time. So business has been fully involved. In fact, the largest proportion of the fund has been taken up by business, followed by municipalities have access, followed by the NGOs. So that's accessible to all, not only to business, but municipalities as well. In terms of Honourable Michael Bell, we intend to have a further briefing of the portfolio committee on the formal position going into Paris, the formal negotiating mandate going into Paris, and at that time we will be able to brief you on the final form of the INDC. So that's the intention. Honourable Chair, given the confidentiality of our negotiating position, the actual negotiating position, we would request that that particular meeting would be a closed meeting. In terms of the response measures, yes, it is a big ship to turn. The reality of the response measure issue politically is that it raises two extremely contentious political issues. One is liability, and the second one is compensation, or the two are interlinked. And the developed world argue that liability and compensation is not within the mandate of the UNFCCC. So in real terms, those disputes are taken to the WTO and the WTO dispute resolution mechanisms, where there's such a dispute like the cut flower dispute. So that's where we deal with those. So the response measure topics in the UNFCCC deal with the issue of how does a country who is economically dependent on a high carbon economic activity shift its transition its economy to low carbon. So there we're dealing with issues like economic diversification, we're dealing with risk management issues and risk reduction issues. So we are avoiding the political issues of liability and compensation and dealing with those under the international body with the mandate to do so, and focusing on the transition part of the effort in the UNFCCC. In terms of the question around how long it would take to get quantified allocation of equity, my feeling is that we'd never get there. It's a debate like graduation. So how do you graduate from being a least developed country to a developing country? How do you graduate a developing country to be a developed country? And it's just politically, it seems to be such an intractable political question. And really the approach that we've taken around this is that as it's emerging in the negotiations, we're doing the bottom-up INDC approach. It's a all the countries' individual efforts, this is what we achieve, and then you have international cooperation on those, because there is mitigation potential, which is too expensive for a country perhaps to take advantage of. There's also mitigation potential which happens beyond national jurisdiction. So the aviation emissions, for example, they actually happen over the sea. So there's no national jurisdiction over those emissions. Same with shipping. So you get those emissions that we have to deal with. And then you've got other kinds of approaches, like under the Montreal Protocol, the HFCs, so a man-made or synthetic greenhouse gas, you can put measures like phase down. Internationally, globally, we phase down and we phase out these gases with high global warming potential. So those kinds of international cooperation mechanisms to close the gap. So that's fundamentally the best effort as opposed to a quantified attribution. So those are the big words. but basically we're saying all countries, please put forward your best effort, and then we'll look at the remaining potential out there, and we'll look at methods of through international cooperation to close the gap between what we do and what's required by science.
But can you say to a country, your best effort is not the best? Now, at that forum, you are America. You were not impacted upon negatively by the Second World War. You continued polluting like nobody's business. You still continue. You can say the same, for instance, to a country like China, that we are building so many power stations, all of them using. Can't you do better? I'm now being a devil's advocate. Can't you do better? We know that you are negotiators there. You try not to step on other people's toes. Within that ambit, can't you say what you are doing will not do any justice to the cause that all of us are on?
Yes, and that's why we want to build that for a 5-year review cycle. So we want to build in, it's not a compliance mechanism per se. It's more of a peer pressure facilitation kind of mechanism. So in the pre-2020 period, we've got a system that we've already agreed in Durban. Basically, what will happen is every 2 years. So we've got a 5-year review, but every 2 years we've got a system where each country submits a report, a biennial report on what it's doing. And then those reports go into, for developing countries, what we call an international consultation and analysis. So within the international system, you have an analysis of your progress, and there's recommendations on how you can further meet your obligations or improve standing. Developed countries are subject to a system called international assessment and review. So with us, it's a more of a consultation kind of process, but for developed countries, it's a formal assessment and review process on their numbers. So every 2 years, there's this opportunity to engage, and every five years, we want to build in a bigger review in the formulation of the next 5-year commitment. So, yes, we are building, and that's part of our top-down approach. And it's very contentious, and we'll see what comes out in Paris. But we are pushing hard for that. How can we help farmers to adapt? Well, as the impacts of climate change are being felt, there are a number of different impacts. But to a large extent, most of them are dealt with in water. So there are really two big steps that So the first step is a technology shift from overhead sprayers and canal irrigation to drip irrigation. So high efficiency water use, that's the one. So a technology shift. The second kind of adaptation is what we call a crop switching. So let's look at the wheat belt, for an example, the swipe line of wheat belt where the wheat is grown. In real terms, with climate change, that climate that's suitable for wheat has actually shifted about 300 kilometers southward. So you've got what we call stranded assets. So all the silos and the infrastructure that is intended for the wheat is stranded over here in a climate where it's no longer suitable for wheat. And the wheat is now growing 300 kilometers down the road. So in this area, we need to do a crop switch. So the crops need to change to crops which can grow in the new climatic condition. And the new wheat area, we need to be able to shift the infrastructure supporting the wheat industry to the new wheat area. So, I mean, these are practical problems on the ground, and we're already beginning to see those kinds of adaptation responses being taken by the industry themselves. So if you look at the wine industry in South Africa, you've seen that the vineyards are now growing up the slopes. So previously the vineyards were in the valleys, and as the climate is changing, so you get the vineyards growing on the slopes, which have got more suitable climate. So the vines in the valleys, they're switching to different varieties of grapes which can handle this, and they're growing the old grapes on the slopes now. So those are the kinds of responses that we're beginning to see already. So there is a lot of work being done. I think the Minister of Agriculture launched what they call Climate Smart Agriculture Initiative for South Africa. The linkage between adaptation and mitigation, there is a meeting of minds. There's increasing momentum around the contention that adaptation is a core element of the Paris Agreement. And this is evidenced by, in the Green Climate Fund, $100 billion per year by 2020. They've already made a decision at the Green Climate Board level that 50% of resources will be allocated to adaptation and 50% to mitigation. So there's this increasing momentum, political momentum behind that, and it's evidenced by the US putting its adaptation submission and the EU putting separate undertakings on adaptation. So there's this increasing political momentum behind that. So Africa has succeeded to a large extent in pushing that agenda item. So how it pans out in Paris, we'll see. Alright. On this issue of defining a developed and a developing country, fundamentally this is the biggest, one of two big political issues that has to be solved in Paris. The US is in a place where they cannot sign up to an agreement which has a binary architecture that separates developed and developing. In the form of the convention, which has an Annex 1, Annex 2, and a non-Annex 1. So Annex 1 in the convention is all developed countries. Mm-hmm. Annex 2 in the convention is question of how to differentiate between countries is the biggest political nut to crack. But my sense is that there's a willingness to crack it. But there's also a lot of countries that just want to say this is under the convention, Annex 1, non-Annex 1, Annex 2. So it's going to be the biggest contention, one of the biggest contention issues that will probably be the last night in Paris. One of them.
Colleagues, I would like us to, we can come back to any other questions, but I would like us to finalize the mitigation ambitions, or what do you call it? Okay. Or you. the platform is yours.
Thanks, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Member. I'm going to give you a high-level presentation. It does not include some of the detailed elements of the mitigation system. We are in the process of developing the South African mitigation system, which is basically kind of about the reduction of emissions. And those are the key elements. We're looking at the carbon budget. I'll talk briefly about what we mean by allocating carbon budgets. And then we are in the process of finalizing pollution prevention plan regulations. I'll also talk to that later on. They are called mitigation plans in the National Climate Change Response Policy, but I'll tell you why we call them pollution prevention plans in respect of greenhouse gases. And then one other element, it's the carbon tax, and then we've got the final element, which is the monitoring and evaluation. Next. Okay. Looking at the first cycle, we're implementing the system in phases, and I'll elaborate on the reasons why we're implementing the system in phases later on. The first cycle on your left, which is in blue, is the first phase, which is going to be implemented from 2016 up to 2020. The top rectangle there is basically about the mitigation potential analysis, which was completed last year. This is a document that was published. It's on our website. It has gone to cabinet. It basically identifies mitigation potential, the technical feasibility in different sectors in terms of what sectors are capable of doing in terms of reducing emissions. And we've used the integrated resource plan, which is published by the Department of Energy, for the energy assumptions that were used in the mitigation potential analysis. And at the moment, we are in the process of setting carbon budgets for companies. And then once we've allocated carbon budgets, we will be calling for pollution prevention plans by companies that have carbon budgets. And then the annual reporting cycle will commence in 2016 once we've allocated the carbon budgets. And then we'll assess the compliance at the end of the first phase. There's not going to be any compliance mechanism for the first phase. And then the cycle on your right is basically the second and subsequent phases of the carbon budget. It's similar to the first phase. We may tweak it once we've learned and investigated some of the elements in the first phase. Next slide. Well, the carbon budget is a means of regulating greenhouse gases in the country. We will be allocating an emission reduction allowance to a company. And we've identified companies, not all companies will be getting carbon budgets. For the first phase, we're targeting the biggest emitters in the country. And the criteria that we've used, we're saying all companies that emit more than 0.1 megatons per annum will be allocated the carbon budget. But to deal with competition issues, and that's an opinion that we got from the Competition Commissioner, is to say that once you've identified the sector with a 0.1 company, then all other companies within that sector need to get a carbon budget. At the moment, we have plus 70 companies identified for carbon budgets. And we've also made provision for those companies that have not been identified but would love to have a carbon budget in the first place, so they can still apply to the department to get a carbon budget. And due to lack of data, we're implementing a phased approach, the first phase, which is going to start in 2016 after 2025 year cycle. the second phase will start in 2021. Hopefully by then we'll have legislation that would help us enforce some of the elements of the common budget. As I said, the first phase will commence on the 1st of January 2016 and end on the 31st of December. The key goal of the first phase is to test the system and to also investigate some of the elements that we will need to inform the post-2020, which is basically the phase that's starting in 2021. And there won't be any compliance mechanism. What we have done is we have sent out letters to companies requesting emissions data from 2000, and they started responding. So we hope to finalize most of the carbon budgets before end of this month so that they can start preparing pollution prevention plans. The design element, as I said, is 5-year cycles. We've built a degree of flexibility within the system. So meaning once we've allocated a 5-year budget to a company, we leave it to them to allocate as to how much are they going to be reducing per annum. So there's that flexibility for them to decide how they're going to spread the 5-year budget within the 5 years. So for instance, if we give them 50 tons, it's up to them. We're not going to say spread it 10, 10, 10 over the 5-year period. If they decide we're only going to do 5 tons first year, the next year we're doing 15 tons, it's up to them, entirely up to them. So that's the flexibility that we've built into the system. And some of the principles that guide the allocation of the carbon budget, it's basically to support existing operations. So in our request to companies to submit emissions data, they need to tell us if there's going to be any measures, any growth in their production so that we can make provision for those in the allocation of the carbon budget. The National Pollution Prevention Plans, we have used the Air Quality Act to come up with regulations that will basically prescribe submission of pollution prevention plans with regards to greenhouse gases. We have published the regulations and we are in the process of incorporating comments, and we will be publishing them again because there's been a few changes to the regulations. But basically, we expect any company that has been allocated the carbon budget to present their pollution prevention plan, to tell us exactly how are they going to reduce their emissions and what measures are they going to put in place to reduce their emissions and to achieve their carbon budget. And then they'll need to submit their pollution prevention plan to the department, and then we scrutinize it depending on what is detailed in the document. We will either accept it or refer it back for improvement so that they can meet their current budget. Next, the other element of the system is the desired emission reduction outcomes and the mix of measures. That's what we call the DEROs and the MOMs. We are in the process of setting structural aspirational goals per sector, and we'll be setting those in the 5 sectors: agriculture, energy, industry, transport, and waste. Like the carbon budget, we're also approaching this in a phased approach. The first phase, we will be allocating the DEROs for the short term, which is up to 2020, and medium term up to 2030. The National Climate Change Response Policy talks to medium, short term, and long term. But for the first phase, we're only going for up to the medium term. And we're going to use the mitigation potential analysis as a basis to identify desired emission reduction outcomes. So basically identifying some of the lowest hanging fruits in the mitigation potential analysis, because it clearly states what interventions need to be put in place to reduce emissions. It also quantifies the emissions perspective. And then the second element is the mapping of appropriate mix of policy measures per sector. So basically to say what measures do we have in place to support emission reductions in the country in different sectors. For instance, the IRP would be one measure, and any other government interventions to support emission reductions, like your National Cleaner Production Center that you said to support companies to reduce their emissions. So we will be documenting all those interventions, including any other incentives that are available to support emission reduction in the country. We have been engaging with the National Treasury on the alignment of the carbon tax and the carbon budget. Yes, and we
align the two instruments. And at the moment, the option that we've presented to business, and we've just received their comments, basically not agreeing to this option that we've presented, the option that we've put on the table at the moment, which is still a draft, is to allocate an additional 5% to any company that has a carbon budget. The carbon tax has a number of allowances for different sectors and for different activities. For instance, there's a 60% threshold on all companies that are going to be taxed. If you are trade exposed, there's an additional 5%. So we're adding another 5% for any company that participates in the carbon budget. And that will increase the maximum tax threshold to 95%. So basically, you'll only be taxed on 5% of your emissions. And it will reduce your tax liability. So this is what we have presented. It's on the table, and it's still being discussed with all relevant stakeholders. The next slide talks to the greenhouse gas reporting. These are the regulations that were published, and the time for submission of comments has closed now. We've received comments on the reporting. It basically makes it mandatory for companies to submit greenhouse gas data. At the moment, we're doing that on a gentleman's agreement, basically, and an MOU, a very broad MOU with Business Unity South Africa. So this will make it mandatory for companies to submit their emissions data, and it will also enable us to collect data from companies and help us to meet our international obligations in terms of submitting the greenhouse gas inventory and also inform us in drafting a national policy on climate change. Next slide, which is basically some of the supporting programs that are currently underway in different departments. There's a mitigation technology plan. We, together with the Science and Technology Department, we have just completed the work on the mitigation technology plan, basically to better understand what is required to support the implementation of some of the technologies that have been identified in the mitigation technology plan. It's still a draft document. It's on its way now to cabinet. And then the policy also says the EDD needs to lead, economic development needs to lead on the national employment vulnerability assessment to look at the impact that any climate change intervention has on jobs in different sectors. And then environmental assessment, we are also in the process of coming up with a socio-economic impact to assess the impact of carbon budgets. We'll only be doing this for the first phase to see what impact is it going to have on the economy. And we'll report back when that piece of work is concluded. Thanks.
There we are. It's good that you corrected that, that we are not talking about ambitions. We are talking about systems, what we are putting in place to realize whatever ambitions later on. Having said that, you see, the Lima Agreement, I'll come to you, colleagues. The Lima Agreement is very clear. And again, as you have said, it says we must put, in terms of actual tonnage, the reductions that we aspire to achieve. Now, we can see where we are going with everything that we are putting here. But when we come to the ultimate end, which is October, just next month, where will we realize these wonderful goals that we want to realize with everything? Now, I don't know why, again, we waited until now with all this, whether we were a little bit sleeping on the job. With all these supporting measures for us to realize reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. That's my starting point. Colleagues, the platform is yours. Mam Nyambi, Babu
want to know that is it compulsory that all companies they register for the carbon budget? As now there are 70 companies that have registered. What are the measures that are going to be taken for those companies who will not register for the carbon a carbon budget? And also, I just want to know that the data, does it have the actual number of companies that have to register for the carbon budget? Thank you.
Next.
Thank you very much,
Chair.
I wanted to know who are the contributors on the GCF Green Climate Fund? And the second, okay, actually it's a comment. I was really worried because I was hoping that you would give us sort of like a study, economic study or employment effect that you will have these green checks. But you just mentioned that you would give us on a later stage. It's just a comment. Thank you, Chair.
No, Chair.
Also,
Chair,
just a comment. I've been concerned that the presenter is saying that in the past there was a memorandum of understanding between the companies and the which was a gentleman's agreement, which was not over binding. Now that it is binding. The point that I want to make is that it seems industry can be dictating terms that if they are not ready to implement, they will always counter argue and say we are not ready. And then it seems that we will always play according to their tune. For example, the chief director just presented that they've given the companies two proposals and they are not amenable to the first one. So companies are dictating. Therefore, we are not playing that overall role of implementing sustainable development in as far as regulations are concerned. Secondly, the question that I want to pose, why do you take January the 1st, which is on the US day, that you're commenting there? And are those companies, all of them, are they in a position to respond? And lastly, your capacity around evaluation and monitoring. Do you have the necessary capacity to monitor and evaluate what you will be putting in place?
Thanks.
The first is that we are raising this question for the second time around, I think. That in other countries, carbon tax is controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And we may need once more clarification how we think in South Africa we should go ahead and implement it, knowing fully well that it's one of the options, but just to check whether we're on good course or we needed to employ other options. The second, understanding that we do not have some baseline or data in this regard, but we seem to be starting at a level wherein we are so generous. Because even those companies that we are going to start with, which are emitting high, we are going to even give them additional 5% allowance, even as they start with the carbon budget. And I'm not sure why, but also this over reliance on the industry flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we are just too kind. You know, and perhaps that may need to be explained. For instance, which is the second element, that you are going to be giving them some discretion within the 5-year cycle to choose when to reduce more or emit more. For instance, you won't spread that equally
the budget
in the 5-year cycle. So they may choose in 1 year to emit a lot and cause more harm, to people's lives. And but to me, it's not just whether they are given a budget allowance or not. It's also to try and deal with the effect. Now, if we give it upon or to them, some industries, of course, I know for the sake of the economy and so on, they may not necessarily close shop. But if I were to be in this industry, knowing that I'm about to close shop, I admit for this first year or two and close shop, but the fifth, seventh, I'll have done more damage than the last seconds. You know, I'm just saying, we need much more control and measures to enforce this thing than to just open it to industry to do whatever they think they must do. And lastly, just for you to tell us these measures to incentivize, to encourage and support to reduce emissions. You know, what are they? Are you referring to the 5% additional allowance? What are you referring to? Or is it other measures other than those? Because I'm not sure, I may not be where you are, but I'm not sure that I agree with the additional 5%. And just the whole range of other measures that we see in the and that explains the gentleman's agreement that is there as well. They must see the hand of government being a bit stronger, even right from the word go. Because it's not like they've not been meeting before. They've had their time, they've had their space. Yes, they've done. For us to still say no, we're starting with you, the first 5 years won't be, what did you say? Won't be tough on them. We're not going to be measuring. Yes, the first phase is just to say you are there now, we're going to start with these measures in 2021. But for now, we just know that we are coming for you. You know, when they've been doing this thing all along, I'm just saying that let's be tough even as we start. We may not be very tough, but let's reduce the allowances, you know, that are not so necessary. Thanks.
We have
some. Sorry, thank you, Jay. Just a quick question. I just want to find out, are these carbon budgets, are they within the minimum emission standards? And just explain, you know, just explain a little more around
issues. Just to ask a question that everybody will ask us. They will say, what is South Africa emitting at this point in time? And with all these measures put in place, of course we know we are, because we are alive to us ensuring that whatever we do does not negatively impact on our developmental agenda. But still, comply to the world effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Now, I would have thought that, first of all, this document would have said, this is where we are. And in the world, we are one of the number what? Emitters. 14, around 14, 15. Because of this million tons we are emitting. And therefore, our idea is that over this period and this period and this period, this is how much we want to reduce. We know I don't think that you have put actual figures in the discussion document. You have put, there are actual figures, okay. So it will assist so that we know what we are talking about, because at the moment you give this broad thing that we are going to do, but we are not saying this is our aim, so that we also ask the appointed question. Will you be able to turn around the corner?
try and protect my colleagues. Okay, in the discussion box. The actual numbers are a trajectory range of from 398 megatons to 614 megatons of CO2 equivalent. So that's the range within which we are targeting. Our actual emissions are 517 megatons at the moment. In terms of the question, because I'm pretty sure that the public is going to ask, how is it that we're going to meet this number by 2025? And remember, we're talking about our commitment is to peak by 2025. So the 2030 number is the same number, because it's a peak and plateau. So it's the same numbers for 2030. Peak, plateau, decline. So the numbers are the same for 25 and 2030. In terms of how we're going to meet it, if you will recall, in the IRP and the Integrated Energy Plan, the building of Medupi and Kusile, which is a high efficiency combined cycle turbine technology, is being installed in preparation for the decommissioning of the aging plant. So the situation in South Africa, the major emissions are coming from our energy sector. And it's scheduled for 2022, between 2022 and 2025, 38, the decommissioning of plants, which Kusile and Medupi replace, is 38 megaton reduction just through the decommissioning. And so this decommissioning plan goes up to 2030 in the IRP. So fundamentally, we will be able to, over that period of time, through the decommissioning and the introduction of the high-efficiency Medupi Kusile, and then the introduction of gas turbine power and nuclear and the renewable energy program. Basically what we're doing is we're fundamentally transforming the energy mix of South Africa from the 92% old technology power coal-fired power stations with high emissions, low efficiencies, to some Medupi, Kusile, and a couple of independent coal-fired independent power producers, but all using high efficiency technologies to a mix with a small amount, so it'll be about 10, in 2050 we'll be down to about 10, 11 megawatts installed capacity of coal, as opposed to 44 megawatts of installed coal. And then we've got nuclear, renewables, gas, hydro. So we're fundamentally transforming that energy mix, which the decommissioning. So that's the biggest slice of our mitigation pie, if you want. If you look at our national greenhouse gas inventory, then on top of that, we then have the mitigation system, which is now applicable to the transport sector, the land sector, the industrial sector, whether it's IPC, you want to move it. green IoT.
There is a sense, but some people are saying, you know, even these power stations that are supposed to be decommissioned in 50 years, they can still run for another, which complicates the very same argument that you're making. They can still run for another. So we have been to this, We have been to Dumba, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
We have been to this power station where they are saying, why this is our lifespan, but we can still increase. I'm just saying this because in it, as we put this scenario, there must be certainty that indeed, come a particular timeline, we will indeed make the plateau. When we don't make the plateau, when we continue to go up, whose head should we chop yours?
Well, we can only draw. Chair, I understand and I hear this expand life cycle, expand this language, but the official documents in the IRP and the IEP, those are the only documents that we can actually with certainty go. Those are policy decisions of government. Those are not, something we're sucking out of our thumb. So if those things change, then we'll have to relook. But at the moment, that's a policy decision. And we rely on this committee to put pressure on government to stick with its own policy decisions in terms of this. If you look at renewable energy IPP program, the Minister of Energy has expanded the fifth window by a further 13 bidders at the moment. So instead of that window being 3.6 megawatts installed capacity of renewable energy, so we're now looking at 6.3, more than double. So government is sensitive to these issues. And the real question is, how do you replace our plant on the one hand, and how do you increase the installed capacity because of the increased demand going forward? That's fundamentally the question. So we are calculating our contributions in terms of this policy, in terms of other formally adopted policies, not on talking corridors around expanded life cycles and so on and so forth. And we would rely on this committee to help us enable government to stick with its stated policy and plan. But if that stated policy and plan changes, then we'll have to have a relook at how we can do that. But at the moment, that decommissioning schedule is a key element of this. So the mitigation system deals with the industrial processes to a large extent and the land sector to a large extent. And I'd like to just kick over to the other question around the 5% allowance. I think Honourable Makubela asked that. The 5% allowance is not it's a tax break, and it's an incentive. It's not linked to the ambition to the budget. The budget is still imposed, but it's an incentive for the company to join to get the budget. So the budget is the level of ambition. The 5% allowance is the tax break. It's an incentive to get them to join. Well, I'm only an official of government, and if my government, through this committee, says that we must take a stronger, more command and control approach to this, we will develop the policy to do so. But at the moment, this policy is framed as much in terms of creating incentives to join the system. So if you're getting a 5% tax break and you're below 0.1 megatons, you're a company below 0.1 megatons, you still got to pay your carbon tax. So there's a real incentive to join the system, even though you're emitting below the 0.1, just to get the tax break. So it's an incentive to get more and more. So the system will be mandatory for all companies above 0.1 megatons to join, to register. That would be mandatory. But you want to create a system where the other smaller companies will be joining on a voluntary basis. But once you've joined, you've joined. Then it's mandatory. Yeah, once you've joined, you've joined. It's become mandatory.
It's like that. It's fine.
Yeah.
Oh, gee, you're going to kill us.
Okay. So yes, the carbon tax is a globally carbon tax base is a controversial. But our research has indicated that those countries which have used the carbon tax, like Denmark, the Nordic countries, some countries in the EU that have used carbon tax have been ultimately very successful. There are a number of different ways in which carbon tax is implemented. The way in which this carbon tax is proposed, South Africa's one is proposed, is a economy-wide carbon tax. Whereas there are other systems which are sector-based. So you get carbon tax on the transport sector, the electricity sector, and so on and so forth. So there are different ways in which you implement, you could implement the carbon tax. But I would propose that the committee ask the Treasury officials to come and explain their research, their global research on best practice in terms of that. I do know that in Australia, it was converted, the carbon tax was converted to a political issue.
Yes.
It wasn't a technical issue at all. It was used to depose prime ministers and things
yes.
like that.
And not once.
And not once. More than once. And the current one looks vulnerable
yeah.
as well. For exactly the same issue. Yeah. Chair, the outstanding question relating to, I think from Honourable Mavido, relating to monitoring and evaluation capacity, we have over the past since Durban, basically, we've been building our capacity. So we've been working on this carbon mitigation, the mitigation system, the adaptation system. And preparation for the INDC since 2011. And the department created in 2011 the climate change branch. At the moment, the monitoring and evaluation chief directorate, which would be responsible for monitoring and evaluating this, has a capacity of 23 staff, many of which are experts, some of which are world experts. Leading the world in monitoring and evaluation. I must acknowledge, and maybe the committee can even acknowledge publicly, that the government of Germany has assisted us through their climate. They auctioned their units in Germany and generate funds, and that fund has assisted us in building our capacity. So we should acknowledge Germany in particular. But other governments were helping us to build our capacity. The climate change branch is now 100. 17. I think that the whole climate, the branch is climate change and inequality. Brian's 23 or but I think we're in the region of 70 staff in the climate section, and about about 70 staff in the air quality section. Remember that the greenhouse gas inventory, the South African air quality information system is the repository for the greenhouse gas inventory. So the air quality side also contributes to the climate side. In terms of there was a question on air quality. Emission standards. Even that's your question. I can't answer that. So I've answered the question about what South Africa is emitting currently. So Chair, I mean, the fundamental balance that we are trying to strike is this balance between legitimate rights to sustainable development, addressing poverty, addressing inequality, and creating jobs, while at the same time making a fair contribution to the global effort. Our analysis, we have done an impact analysis, but not in association with the 2014 mitigation potential analysis, but with the LTMS, the long-term mitigation scenarios. That analysis showed that the impact in terms of household welfare, and that included the carbon tax in that analysis, was negligible impact at household level. As long as the carbon tax revenues were recycled into social safety net. So it had a positive impact on job creation because you were creating whole new sectors. Solar water heater sector, renewable energy sector, building energy efficiency sector. So these new sectors of the economy were coming in. So in terms of job creation, the spin-offs were positive. But it did say that you would have to recycle the revenue generated through the carbon tax in a manner that reinforced the social safety net in order to minimize the impact of these policies at household level. Now, the analysis that we're doing is a much further detailed study based on the 2014 study. So we do have the 2007 study, but we want to do a much more detailed in terms of the New Year's Day, well, this is a 5-year period. There's going to be 4 New Year's Days on after that. So we're not worried about this kicking off on the 1st of January. There'll be some more of them in the whole cycle. Our understanding is that one of the reasons that we're involving industry and business in the early preparatory stages is that they're ready to kick off before January 1st, so they're ready to implement.
Yeah, I don't know if you know that the issue of health is easy. It goes just like we have said in the past, the targets that the government is giving, especially here, some of them are not much on the portfolio. If you talk about commencement, I don't want to deliver the decision. It's the date when you will say you've complied and you've complied. And it's on a Friday. And it's a holiday. So I'm saying that date was not well thought of. You could have thought about the 4th, which is on a Monday. I have the calendar of 2016. But I think the department must not be referred. The date is not appropriate. It's on a holiday, it's on a Friday. Here it is. So if you say maybe the 4th, I don't want to belabor it, I'm just raising it. For me it's clearly, because you will not be able to measure whether on that day it was there, because there's no one. Unless you create the basic employment act, and people must go to the holiday and say two times. I just raise it. I don't just want you to just give a day for the sake of the day. Because when I did my research, it's on a Friday, it's on a Friday.
I saw somebody doing the NES.
2021. We're trying to have a full calendar year. And by that time, we would have all the systems in place. So we don't expect companies to do anything on the 1st. And if you look at the monitoring and evaluation system that we put in place, we're expecting them on an annual basis on the 31st of March to record on the previous year. So we don't expect anything from them in January per se, but they're thinking they should have a full calendar year. So when you talk about your emissions, you'll be talking about whether you are emitting on the 1st of January or not. You'll be covered on the 1st of January.
No. The issue here is when you put the 1st of January as a compliance date of anything, you are not helping you or us. Put another day. Whether you put the 4th or the 5th or the 6th, because when you say the 1st, all of us know, many of us will be roused out of our minds just from that perspective. Unless you are speaking about something that has no effect on being monitored and evaluated.
You are correct, Chair. I've just said that the compliance is end of March. So after a full calendar year, we give them additional 3 months to prepare the report. So we don't expect them to report on anything in January.
Why is the 1st of January? Why?
No, but we need them to have the system of measuring the emissions in place before the 1st of January. So if they're going to put a monitoring system into their stack to monitor how much carbon is coming out of the stack, that system needs to be in place before the 1st of January so that they've got records which would be automated. Their records begin on the 1st of January. It's not that we want people to go to work, but we want people to have this monitoring system, because remember we're talking about a mandatory reporting that has to be in prior to the start date, which is the 1st of January, so that when they report in March 31st 2017, which would be the date of reporting, they report on the full calendar year from the 1st of January, including the 1st of January through to the 31st of December.
Let's leave that for now, but you know, you are still relying on the air quality legislation on such an important matter, a matter that can destroy the entire world population. Why don't we have legislation? I know other countries, by the way, have legislated on this matter. We are coming up with this regulation and this regulation, but all of them are centered around our air quality laws. We have no legislation that deals with greenhouse gases.
Yeah, Chair, we are proposing to have a climate act. And we sit in the situation that the development of an act goes through a process. So we already have the policy. So we already have the green paper and the white paper cycle already that is complete. So now we're in the stage of drafting at a conceptual level what the substantive content of the Climate Act would be, and then we would want to come to the committee to make a proposal on a conceptual level what the substantive content and get the committee's guidance on that content, and then go through the stage of drafting and iterative engagement through the committee on the climate act. So yes, it is in our program. Deborah can let me just make a reference. So therefore, in the interim, while we are developing the Climate Act, we would like to be able to, at least for the monitoring and evaluation, we have a legal basis through the through the Equality Act to put regulations in place through that. It's not ideal, but we need it in the absence of the Climate Act. So one would anticipate that the transitional provisions that, or the provisions at the end of the Climate Act would repeal those regulations that were made in terms of how that act and reissue those same regulations in terms of the Climate Act as the Climate Act gets sent to by the President. So we don't want to stop implementing because we don't have a Climate Act. We want to implement as much as we can in the absence of a Climate Act. Just to be very clear, the one thing that the Equality Act cannot do, it cannot do the budgets. It just can't do the budgets or the DEROs. It can't do that part of the system. And it's not a money bill, so it can't do the carbon tax either. The carbon tax has to be through the Excise Act, which is published by Treasury. So it will be an act which is actually needs to cross-reference others, because it will have to cross-reference transport legislation, energy legislation, and agriculture legislation, and so on. So it is a complicated piece of legislation, but we are in the process. I don't know how far we are, Deborah, on that.
Before you respond, Deborah, you say, why I'm asking about it, you're saying due to lack of data, as you talk of carbon budgets. Now, you see, when you say due to lack of data, it means that even the data that we might receive from those who are supposed to give us, verification of that data will remain a serious problem. And that's the difficulty we have now with our municipality on air quality, by the way. Where, in fact, they have not data. Why they have not? Who licensed these companies, by the way? The ones that we are saying we have not data from. Are they not licensed by the state?
No,
there is no licensing there, by the way. Only for air quality we license them. And for this very dangerous thing, they are unlicensed. So they can greenhouse gas us to death as they like until we get our act together. So a very strange country, but answer the question that
Okay. I think you're right, Chair, that the biggest constraint in the implementation of the mitigation system is lack of legislation. I mean, you can stretch the Air Quality Act to a point. As you know, that we tried to insert the elements of the DEROs on the carbon budget, but we couldn't. So we can only come up with regulations. And also the other element where there was a constraint, but we've managed to use the Air Quality Act is the greenhouse gas reporting. As we've indicated, that at the moment there are companies that are submitting greenhouse gas data to the department, but it's not mandatory for all companies to submit. So once the regulations are out there, then it will become mandatory for all companies to submit their greenhouse gas emissions.
In short, we're saying, whilst we know what levels of mega or millions megatons, we don't know who are the contributors.
We do.
How? You guess?
We do. Most of the major emitters are submitting their data, but there's nothing that forces them. We have an MOU with Bursa, so they have been submitting data. But it's not comprehensive enough to cover everyone in the economy. Even the smallest guys are out there.
The data that they are submitting, how verified is that data? How reliable is that data? Because they can also, and that's the point that we have been raising on air quality, by the way. That indeed we have got systems, we have air quality monitoring stations, all sorts of things, and we have even forced companies to put infrastructure that will measure the aspects, like I say, and everything else, but on the other pollutants, not your greenhouse gas emissions. I don't know why we left that out. But be that as it may, how this question number 14. How reliable is this when a government we can't verify?
Well, we do have indirect verification methodology. It's called a mass balance approach. So you know what goes in, you know the volume of oil that and petroleum, say for example, that South Africa's consumed. You know the volume of coal that is being consumed, and you know what process it goes into. And then there's the IPCC International Emissions Factor. So you've got an indirect quality assurance control, but you are 100% correct as a direct verification. Its system needs to be jacked up. So indirectly through our greenhouse gas inventory, we have an indirect verification process where you can do it per sector, not per site. So you can say, for all the transport that are burning diesel and petrol, we know how much was consumed, we know what kind of engines it went through, and what the emissions actually should be, and you compare that against what's reported collectively from that sector. So there's that indirect from a scientific and technical perspective. But the methodologies for direct verification need to be put in. So at the moment we have voluntary reporting, and there's no system or legislative legal grounds for us to go, and unless there's something dramatically
but
wrong.
You know that we must be worried as public reps that we can only rely on general principles of verification. On such, you know, the whole world, we know when even the Pope stands up and says, can we do something? We as a country can't verify this, the levels of this pollutant that is so destructive to the world economy and particularly to the communities that are so vulnerable, African communities, that cannot be so resilient to the effects of climate change. And we are so far away, we don't even have legislation. That's there. You can say whatever that you want to say, Alf, it is bad for us as a country. Because then, without legislation, there are certain things that we can do. Maybe you must first fret that legislation.
Yes.
Maybe you should.
Chair, we will come to you. Can I just consult with our legal services? They have the discussion the concept document, which they're busy vetting. Can I engage with our legal services and arrange a date with the committee to come and at least present at a concept level the concept legislation? I can't say, give you an exact date now, but we've arranged with Chilek for that date. So we already have a draft. It's a matter of getting the vetting and arranging a date to come and present. But I do agree with you, Chair. I think that that we are. Remember. I have to defend South Africa in this instance. Remember that we were in a system with Kyoto Protocol where there were a system of no legal obligations on developing countries, but legal obligations on developed countries. And those legal obligations enabled the purchase of units of tons from developing countries. So in that system, there was no requirement for developing country to have climate legislation. We're now moving into a system which only began in 2011, that decision was made in 2011 in Durban, a system where obligations are going to be placed on all parties. And we find ourselves 4 years down the line at this stage.
We are in 2015.
Yes, 4 years.
You see, we are in 2015. We can go to other developing countries who were in the same position as we were in 2011 and see how far they move. We will do that, that research. We will do that research.
Yeah, it's Mexico and Brazil.
Yes.
Yeah, Mexico and Brazil. And bits and pieces in China. China has taken a very fragmented approach. India and South Africa are basically at the same kind of level, where we are policy driven rather than legislative driven. But we can do that and report to you internationally how we compare, if you want. Or you can get your Scotney to do that.
But we have made our point. There are certain things that you can do. You see, even policy, when you have policy, and by the way, policy has at times this very funny way of moving goalposts. When you wrap policy in a legislative framework, you have got nobody who can say something else tomorrow, by the way. You have nobody, because then you have a clear legislation passed by Parliament that even says, by this 10 years, this is where we'll be informed by this policy directive that has been crafted by our government. Therefore, this legislative framework. But when you have not tied people to a legal instrument, you then talk broadly on policy articulation, I can tell you. I've seen some policies in my own government, many. Some that are better not discussed here.
Okay, point taken. We will come, the point is taken, we will come as soon as possible with the concept legislation.
Are there questions that you have not answered?
I think there's two that she has not answered. The common budget being within the minimum emission standards. The answer is no, we don't have emission standards for greenhouse gases. We look at the threshold when we draft legislation as to how much can we emit per gas. And then the other question from Honorable Makubela is the over-reliance on business, the flexibility within the five-year period. That is not going to compromise the carbon budget. So we're not going to give you a license to emit however much you want to. What we are basically saying is that you can play around with the numbers rather than just having a fixed number, a single fixed number per year. But it's not going to compromise. You still need to be within. No, it shouldn't go above what you've been allocated.
Yeah, it doesn't solve the problem of a company that knows it's going to close down. So, I mean, there is that point.
The information we have in communicating the greenhouse gas data now in the letters that we've requested or we sent to them, they need to communicate those issues as well. Whether there's going to be managed as well as they're shutting down any activities.
No, you know, we have all these measures that we are putting into place. Why now, when we have been there since 2011? Now, I'm saying about all this because this will also inform what type of legislative framework you put into place. Why have we, I think we have left it until late. We had this on air quality, we have moved. We have got set standards, and indeed we are enforcing those standards. We wanted to call some people on the 22nd, but we can now. because of this one. And we have prioritized this one, even though we don't have any legislation. That's why we're calling all these others that you might not have consulted to have an opportunity to speak to us. My worry is, why on such an important matter on climate change we have moved at such a speed? Is there any reason, unless you are saying that the speed is equal to the task, from where I'm seated, I don't think so. Because even now, we are still expecting, we are not anywhere on carbon budget, by the way. Yes, we do know what we want to achieve. We do know that there are certain things that we need to get from industry. Again, the alignment between your carbon tax and your carbon budget, again, as we are visiting industry, they were saying they are more comfortable with your carbon budget than the carbon tax, by the way. That's what they were saying. And they were saying, and all these things are from one government. We said, okay, by the way, we are not from that arm of government that deals with taxes. We are from that arm that deals with budget, called carbon budget. But all those these issues, and again, we are talking about something so detrimental to the world, more detrimental than your pollutants in the air quality section. More terrible. But we have moved at a snake. What is the thing that moves slower than the snake?
Snails.
From where I'm sitting, even though we might have done the scenarios, but those scenarios without us unpacking this type of work and working on everything that we're saying here and other things that we have not raised. Of course, the decommissioning and whatnot and whatnot. We are nowhere. We can't even come up with our own intended nationally determined contributions. At this point in time, we are still very far off in October. That was the other question. And October is just, are we supposed to just give indications? Or are your scenarios, long-term scenarios, applicable in this case?
Let me touch on the timing and the international process. Remember, this is a commitment that only begins in 2020. And the process internationally is that, and that's why it's got an I intended, nationally determined contribution. So the process would be to put the intended nationally determined contribution, which we are ready to go, we're just finishing the consultation process, into the system, that is to intended to provide momentum and confidence into the negotiation of the final agreement in 2015. That agreement needs to then go through ratification processes. So we have the period between end of December 2015 to end of December 2019, the end of December 2019, to conclude our domestic ratification process, yes. In terms of the planning of the program from 2011, the first steps that we focused on in 2011 were the high impact steps. So we call them, in the policy we call it flagship programs, the 8 flagship programs. And that included the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Program, which is an amazing success. Globally, it's a world-leading program. We focused on our adaptation programs, so bringing coherence and increased investment in the Working for Water, Working for Wetlands, Working for Fire. So a big focus around our expanded public works programs in agriculture and deer in order to do that. Then we worked very hard with the Department of Energy to increase the number. If you recall, the original target for renewable energy was 10,000 gigawatt hours. We're now at a point where the national target in the IRP is 16% of the total energy mix as renewable, and we're working with the Department of Energy to increase it to between 20 and 25% of the total energy mix. But that's policy work that we're working in partnership with that. Then we work with the Department of Transport in terms of the road to rail policy and the rail infrastructure and the improved public, the Ariaching and Via Vaya and all of those public transports. So what we try to do is to identify those major sectors. So the first part of our work, and remember in 2011 we only started the climate change branch, so we were still building our own internal. And before that, it was me and Judy and Marcella and Deborah.
You were answered it. Yes, but you didn't have capacity. You only started in 2011. You entered to build the capacity. Now we have built it.
Now we're ready to rock and roll.
Good. You'll rock and roll. We'll call you.
Yeah.
We will call you here because the reality is that the entire world, unfortunately, the entire world can't say, you see, you were part of the developing countries. We understand why you could not have moved as fast as you could have done, because there were no expectations from protocol or Kyoto Protocol from you to have certain legislation and to also to do certain things. Whilst we understand that, but from where we are sitting, looking at it globally, we are now there. All of us need to make our own contribution. Therefore, we need to move even more faster.
Just giving advantage, but we still have about a minute just to understand more what are these other greenhouse gases other than carbon dioxide?
Jay, it's a really good question. In the Kyoto Protocol, we identified six greenhouse gases, only six greenhouse gases in the first commitment period, which were the major greenhouse gases in terms of volume and lifespan in the atmosphere and data availability. Once again, data availability played a key role in the identification of that. Before the second commitment period, based on recommendations from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and Science, there was an additional two greenhouse gases added to the six. So in total, there's eight greenhouse gases. Now, three of those greenhouse gases are what are called synthetic. In other words, they're artificially produced. They're not naturally occurring like carbon dioxide. They're man-made. And the problem that we have with the synthetic gases is that the UNFCCC instruments do not provide the most effective way of dealing with the man-made gas. The most effective way of dealing with the man-made gas is to develop a low global warming alternative chemical and substitute that and ban, basically phase out the one with a high impact. That's the model of the Montreal Protocol for ozone gas. So within the domestic scene, the regulatory approach to the man-made synthetic gas will be this phase down, phase out. And we're beginning to do that with the HFCs, the hydrofluorocarbons, which have been a hundreds and thousands, some of them with very long life cycles, in the 1,000 years lifespan in the atmosphere. But the reality is that those are emitted at such tiny proportions that in the bigger picture of climate change, they are insignificant. But it's not to say that we shouldn't take a regulatory approach to phase out those as we progress. But the three main ones, SF6, HFCs, PFCs, and SF6, those three gases are, we need to take a different approach to its regulation. It's not really amenable to a carbon budget. You know, that carbon budget instrument is for these more natural ones like methane and nitrous oxide and carbon dioxide and so on. So different horses for different courses, basically. But our Climate Act needs to provide for that, you see. The problem is that the international instrument doesn't provide for that. That's why there's this big debate to use for HFCs to use the Montreal Protocol.
Just to emphasize that for the third phase, we only cover the 6 Kyoto gases. The others will include in the next phase.
So I was just recommending it to you that because the portfolio committee is dealing with climate change and everything. And not all of us are study biochemistry and so forth. That's a footnote for those that are not common. I mean, CO2 is common, you know, carbon dioxide. But that's a recommendation when you get the 6. That's a footnote to say this is for what this is for. Because there's no way we can there's no way we can avoid that as a portfolio committee we are dealing with. So we must be exposed. It's just a recommendation for the chair.
Colleagues, I think just one thing that we should now say. In terms of our program, are we here on Friday, not yet? Please. We're not sitting on Friday. Next week we're going to I think colleagues have received correspondence. While I'm keeping you here, it was just for you to answer after next week. After next week, 22nd and 23rd, we would like it to be part, the department to be part of those public hearings. So that you listen to what people have to say. If there is a need for immediate response, by all means. If there's no need, so if the department can be part of those public hearings, they will be here. Old assembly. That's where we will be holding them. We are having them for 2 days so that we allow all those who think they've got input to make that input. Of course, we might not be able to get everybody a speaking opportunity, but there are major players that we can't avoid. That we might, for instance, people in national business groups, if there are any environmental groups in universities that we would like them to be part of this exercise. But at the moment, in our wording of the address that we'll send out, is that we are asking all interested parties to make submissions. We will also refer them to the discussion documents so that as they come there, they've also seen and read the discussion document, and then they make submissions to the discussion document, and then take it from there. But again, on behalf of the committee and all of us, it's quite clear that we are still going to have some more engagement on these matters before we go to that place, to Paris. But even before we go there, it might be necessary that when we have solicited the inputs of South Africans, including those that you solicited, that we then have a debate in the House on the broad issues, not necessarily on what detail of what will be taken to Paris. So it's something that obviously some of us will be looking at very intensely, so that we have this debate and the position we take broadly, or the parameters around the position we take are parameters that we have discussed in the House. So from where we are, again, I'll thank you. I know that you have been all over the place. You are in Paris. Somebody was saying to me, tell us to put me in a suitcase when you go to Paris to this pre-negotiation session. But again, thank you for coming, and thank you for answering some difficult questions. But this has been helpful. It prepares us for this engagement that we'll have with the stakeholders.
I think if we could just ask Deborah to send that note on the uses of the 6 Kyoto gases before your public hearing, so that you've got the information. So, for example, SF6, which is a fluorinated, what they call a fluorinated gas, is used in power transformers. So it's quite extensive. So Eskom is the biggest user and the biggest emitter in the country of that. So not only do they emit carbon dioxide, they emit this other one as well. So so I think I would, just for information, for some committee members' information, just to have that reference as to what those 6 greenhouse gases is. And lastly, Chair, my and honourable members, my apologies, I will be in New York for the 22nd, 23rd, doing the Sustainable Development Goals in the UNGA. I'm leaving much earlier in September and coming back in the 1st of October. But Deborah, you'll arrange. Deborah will arrange for the department to be there. Thank you.
With those words, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much. Sorry. I know. No, you are enthused. Thank you very much for coming. We know that you arrived when yesterday or so. You are all over the place. This one, colleagues, there's one other item we have discussed on that item for public hearing. We had initially thought that we could have the public hearings on the 24th. Some of us are so unschooled, we never knew that 24th is a public holiday. Now it's Heritage Day. We have now decided to then say let's postpone the Air Quality Summit on the 22nd, because the matter that is of importance and the matter that will be going to an international forum is this one, is this climate change. So we have then brought forward on the 22nd and 23rd this climate change public hearing. We will still have to look at the possible date for the Air Quality Summit. The other reason why we brought forward to the climate change is for all the reasons that we have here, because at any rate, government must present submitted position by October. So it's something that's a little bit beyond us.